And welcome back to the Dr. Lift Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I got my brother, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr. And with us today, we have an exciting guest, Dr. Stu Phillips, the protein guru of the world. He's up in Canada. Oh, Canada. And we've been interacting with him for quite a while.
Long time.
Online. And finally, to meet him, not in the flesh, but kind of via video.
Yeah, we can see him. I don't know if anyone else is going to watch.
As close as we get these days, right?
Yeah. As close as we get.
And really, you really are, you know, in our from our perspective and from what we can tell, one of the globally renowned protein scientists who gives good real life clinical advice. And that's why, I mean, we really are. I was just telling him before we got on, we are so excited to talk about this for our you know, education, and most importantly, our patients and everyone else out there.
Yeah, I used to
appreciate you guys having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
I used to, like, back in high school, it was like 1999, 2002. So, like, there was a point where I was eating like probably 2 grams of protein per pound of body weight. I was eating 400, 500. Like,
now you got to have some background with that. You were a little bit scrawnier than I was going through high school, lifting weights hard, trying to be a heavyweight.
My myostatin gene wasn't turned off in utero like yours was. So but anyway, the point of me saying this is that, like, and even through college and even later through medical school, kind of similar, very high protein. And the thing is, like, you're a high protein guy compared to the general population, but because of your, you know, very evidence-based, science-based recommendations, I've actually peeled back on it a bit.
As have I. And you know, and like you said, I mean, I maintain pretty decent muscle mass. I don't need as much protein as I used to, thanks to actual science.
But what's interesting, though, and I'll let you talk because I don't want to talk over my guests, but, like, what's interesting is when you talk, you're always like, the, you know, most people don't get enough protein. But from our very meathead, protein-ish background, probably getting more than what was needed. So anyway, I just wanted to give that little tidbit there. So thanks sure. for all you do is basically what – I kind of wonder, how'd you get into this stuff? Like, what brought you into protein?
Yeah, it's sort of a bit of a twisted story. I did my undergraduate degree actually here at McMaster University, and I actually did it in biochemistry. So I kind of came at things maybe a little bit different than some people. But I was a rugby guy going all the way through McMaster. So I hung out with a lot of wrestlers, like guys like you, and a lot of other athletes, right? So it was always part of, you know, who I was or my DNA. And it wasn't until my senior year, I actually took a course in nutrition, and this professor who turned out to be my master's advisor, Stephanie Atkinson, was talking about, you know, protein. And she said, I have this student and his name's Mark Tarnopolsky, and he's a clinician, and he still is actually the director of the Neurometabolic Disease Clinic over here. And he said, oh, yeah, we're doing protein requirements in athletes. And I was like, oh, my God, this sounds too good to be true. And yeah, so I got into research. I all along, I thought I'm going to be a clinician. And I got into it, and I've never gotten out of it. So it's always sort of been part of who I am, and a lot like you guys, although my high school career predates yours by at least a solid decade. Every protein supplement I ever took was made by, when I took them, was made by Joe Weider.
Awesome.
And yeah, like, it was, you know, a trip in yesteryear of bodybuilding lore. they tasted awful. By comparison to today's standards, which things taste excellent.
Yes.
It was literally plug your nose and just, you know, pound back your Weider protein supplement.
That is funny, you know, to compare to us then. So I'm 4.5, basically 4 years ahead of Spencer, like in school grade. So I graduated high school in 98. And I don't think, Spencer, see if you recall this. I don't think I ever, as a little kid meathead, lifting weights my whole life, getting into the stuff, I don't think I ever used any protein supplementation until maybe Spencer started trying it when he was in high school. Or maybe I was still in high school, but I didn't use it in high school. I just knew I had a little. Our dad was a biology teacher,
and
he was an athlete, and you know, into food science and stuff. So we always had some basic understanding of, hey, we need to get our protein. Yeah. We need to eat our good fats, you know, a lot of that kind of stuff. But yeah, I don't think I ever had any protein supplementation for my physique.
Because the steaks in the 90s. That you would eat were like 20 ounces.
Well, that's true, I guess.
Yeah, you know, you had to mail order for this stuff. Like you wrote on a little coupon, you put it in the mail, and you got it back. You know, it was snail mailed protein delivery. I don't ever recall there, like, I can't remember it, like a GNC type store. I think the first time I went into one of those, I was definitely in university. And it was mostly protein. Now it's like all kinds of stuff.
It's all goofy stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it's but yeah, I remember getting that, and it was egg. One was egg, and one was beef. Like it was.
Yeah. Beef?
I mean, I don't know.
Oh, terrible. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. So there was no cookies and cream or anything else that. They were So
that sounds terrible.
Yeah, it wasn't fun. I'll admit that.
Well, it also wasn't fun when Spencer added so much supplementation that the rest of us had to live in his methane gas world.
Yeah, that was a side effect of the weeder supplements too. So, but you know, we were a house full of rugby guys, and so it was just like one after the other. You know, it was. Imagine if you came in from the outside and you weren't nose blind. To how bad we smelled.
Spencer almost got kicked out of one of the Michigan State dorms for that. He and his roommate stunk up the whole dorm.
It happens. It happens.
It's not necessarily incorrect. It's a little bit more of that story, but that's not far off.
All right, so let's get
nothing
to some
like
basics.
Some toilet humor to get things going.
Yeah, that's what we do. So, but let's tell people, you know, Spencer, see what you think, but like tell people what the heck is protein, because I'm not so sure everyone quite understands it. You know, an essential amino acids for people out there, and you know, and we have patients who are not athletes, so we're talking little kids to, you know, prevention medicine, healthy adults, people with obesity, diabetes, and of course then athletes. What the heck is protein? What are essential amino acids? What do we care?
I mean, so what I start off with is sort of saying to people, like, so you've got fats, carbohydrates, and proteins, and I said, unlike fats and carbohydrates, which are mostly fuel. I mean, we probably have no requirement for carbohydrate, but you know, most people like carbs. We have a very small requirement for fats. The only nutrient that we actually really need is protein, and that's because we can't store it. We don't have a sort of little place to kind of tuck it away and, you know, put it there and get it at a later time. Now we can, you know, muscle is essentially a reservoir for protein, and you know, in times of need, and patients, and probably you guys deal with them, you break down muscle if you need it. So intensive care, wasting situations, cancer, HIV, something like that. But for most mere mortals, you ingest the protein in your diet. It's broken down into amino acids. The analogy I use with the students is to say that the protein, like muscle in your body, is like a brick wall. And it's made up of 20 different bricks. You can make 11 out of the 20. The other 9 bricks are essential, and you have to eat those. And so, you know, you can't make the complete wall unless you have all 20 of the bricks, but 9 of them come from the outside, and 11 you're making all the time. So, you know, with that in mind, I say to people, you know, the brick wall can't get bigger, or it really doesn't shrink too much. But the only way to make it bigger once you're done growing is to lift weights. And they're kind of like, okay, but, you know, if I'm going to make the brick wall bigger and bigger, I want more bricks. And I'm like, yeah, but the bigger driver of that is definitely the weightlifting. So, but yeah, I talk about protein from a bricks and wall standpoint. But I also point out everybody thinks muscle, muscle, muscle. And you know, everything in your body, your skin, your heart, your lungs, your intestine, like they're all protein structures. So, and we're turning those over all the time. So we're breaking them down and we're making them again. And in doing so, then you create a very efficient sort of, if you like, upkeep maintenance system for these tissues. And, you know, that's a very efficient way of doing things. But it also means you also have a continuous need for protein, because we're not 100% efficient at recycling the bricks that come out of the wall, if you like. So I just make that pretty clear. Carbs and fats, fuel. protein, the only macronutrient. Like if you're stuck on a desert island, you don't have, like, you're done.
Donezo.
So then I guess, should we talk about, you know, like the old RDA minimum
value? Yeah, that's what
value.
I want to know. That's what I was just going to ask. Yeah, I was like, how did they come up with this?
What's the least amount people need to survive? Yeah. You just said, if you're on a deserted island, you need something.
I know you know the history of how they developed this. You have to.
I mean, the methodology behind it is something called nitrogen balance. And it's exactly as the word sound. It's the balance of nitrogen in versus nitrogen out. So if you take nitrogen in, that's all of the protein-containing foods. And most people think, oh, it's meat, it's eggs. And I'm like, it's dairy. But, you know, a slice of bread even has a small amount of protein in it. So you take all of that, you crush it up, you measure it, and then you measure every route of nitrogen excretion that you have. So for most people, about 80%+ of what they lose in terms of nitrogen. And I talk nitrogen, and it's probably, you know, to point out to your listeners that it's nitrogen that distinguishes protein from carbohydrates and fats, which are just carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens, and only protein or amino acids.
Look at that biochem coming through.
Do we call that still the amino group? Is that what that is?
Yep, amino group, nitrogen.
I remember.
That's not bad. I mean, dredge that one up from the memory banks right there. Yeah, so you measure it in everything that comes out. 80% of it in us comes out in the form of urea, in urine. But fecal nitrogen, sweat nitrogen, if you're clipping your nails, if you're cutting your hair, if you're a woman, if you're having a menstrual period, that's nitrogen loss, right? Mm. So, you know, those are delightful experiments to carry out. I did one for my master's degree like a long time ago. And believe me, you probably don't want to do too many of those in your lifetime. Collecting pee is bad enough, but when, you know, you're collecting everything else,
I know. And unfortunately, the rest of the world is always dealing with the collection of Spencer's fecal nitrogen. But
I don't know where that comes from. But, you know, I mean, you don't need an explanation, but let's just imagine a visual. So we've got these nitrogen balance data, and it's nitrogen in, nitrogen out. It's a really, you know, gross in every sense of the word measure of your need for protein. But that's what forms the basis of what's called the recommended dietary allowance. And it's the amount of protein that goes in versus out. Obviously, if you're net losing protein, you're excreting more nitrogen than you're taking in. If you're net gaining protein, then you're holding on to nitrogen. And the method is, you know, 60, 70 years old. The list of shortcomings of the method is very long and very well recognized, and yet it's still the methodology because people can't agree on what would replace it for determining protein requirements. But let's just say there are other methods, and all of those other methodologies come up with estimates of basic need for protein that are higher than nitrogen balance. So, you know, that's been my rally cry for, you know, 30 plus years. The recommended dietary allowance, or the RDA, is incorrect because it's based in a flawed methodology. And I don't actually think it estimates needs at all. But,
where did they come up with 0.8?
It's the point where the line crosses zero and they add a safety margin. And the amount of protein to balance losses is 0.8 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight per day. So I get it. You're from the United States, so I'll quickly do the math for you. But, I mean, it's about 0.3-something grams of protein per pound. So, again, compare that to your bodybuilding estimates of one gram per pound. It's a very small amount of protein. And I just don't think that meets people's protein needs.
So what would be more from your data that you would suggest?
Well, first I want to know the method that you want, that you think it should be.
But then ultimately the bottom line is, what is the necessary minimum for people?
Yes, I think if you want to push, you know, from 0.8, which I don't think is adequate, up to at least 1 to probably 1.2.
Yeah,
that's where my minimum sits, and then I think you can get benefit to protein intakes up to about 1.6 grams per kilo, or twice the RDA, which is about 0.5 something grams per pound. Now, you know, I've got had a raging discussion with many people online about protein intakes that are higher than that. And I don't deny that there might be some very small, you know, very thin slice benefits. But I don't know what they are. Like, and if they are there, we can't quantify them. So let me just say that, you know, twice the RDA is where I like to have people aim. I think you get a good level of satiety. You feel full when you eat that amount of protein. It's not excessive. Most older people that I consider myself falling into that bracket these days, and that I concern, you know, it's my research, can achieve that with diet. They don't need supplements. They can usually do it through diet. And I think, you know, the one thing I try to get across to people is, you know, 30 years ago, the intake for vitamin C was determined by its ability to prevent scurvy. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that's great. So everybody's, you know, if you eat above this, you're not going to get scurvy. But then we recognized that there were benefits associated with increased intakes of vitamin C. And we haven't done the same for protein. So it's not just prevention of deficiency, which is what the RDA is. It's prevention of deficiency and the recognition that there are some potential benefits to intakes that are higher than the RDA.
Okay. Could you summarize for us the research that's out there that said, okay, these people got around 0.8. I mean, I know it's probably more like recommended to get 0.8, but like sure. 0.8 versus then like, because you're saying there should be an incremental difference yeah. between 0.8 yeah. to yep. like even just 1.2, 1. Yep. Let's just say higher. Because, yep. you know, we care about our muscle, obviously, but we always talk about the inside that counts, like cardiometabolic wise, yep. other functional stuff, yeah. like things that quality of life type of things.
And I guess, can I add on to that just because when you're talking about grams per kilogram or pound mm-hmm. body mm-hmm. weight,
yep.
that's actual body weight.
Yeah.
As yep. opposed to what mm-hmm. you see, like even in the ISSN, which I'm not sure if you were in any of those position papers, but, you know, they a lot of times the science talks about ideal body weight. Mm-hmm, mass mm-hmm. and then yeah. that makes it very confusing not only right. to well, patients but even to us
yeah
you know like so
go ahead
sort of three things then to unpack. So the first is, you know, what do you get when you go above the RDA? So let me start with what we know about the RDA, and particularly in reference to older people. If you put an older person on the RDA, and experiments have done this and fairly tightly clamp them dietary wise, within a 12 to 16 week period, you can see that they lose muscle. So there's already erosion of the substrate that's, you know, that's your protein store. So that's an indication that it's not adequate. You do it for long enough, and if we go now to observational cross-sectional data, people on lower protein intakes are generally weaker. They're not as good functionally. Now, this is into older age, so it's a, you know, I don't know when it happens, how long it takes, but, you know, we don't have enough experimental data interventionally to show these things. These are observational trials, so that's, you know, I think another piece of evidence that I'd add. And from the inside out, I mean, I think that the point would be, you know, once you get up to about 1.6, then you've got to make choices about the other nutrients that you're going to eat. And it's carbohydrates and fats. And so it leaves a lot of room for people to make, I would say, poor choices. But it's even more of a, you know, sort of poorer choice if you're down at a very low protein intake. Plus, there's a satiety effect with protein that I think it maybe gets a little overstated, but I think people feel full or fuller. To the extent that they tend not to overeat. Now that's called a protein leverage hypothesis. And there's some evidence that that exists in humans. People who consume below what they need seek more food to try and get to that requirement. So I think all of those things, when you kind of add them up, it's just a constellation of things that make me think more protein is probably better. From an athlete standpoint, it becomes sort of a fait accompli because most athletes cover their energy needs and then protein comes along for the ride. So they tend to get enough. But to your point, you know, if some is good, more is always better, of course. So.
but also for those, you know, who are trying to lose fat, including, you know, ranging again from our patients with obesity, diabetes, yep, to say athletes. I mean, we talked about being wrestlers, trying to be as lean and mean as possible, but keeping as much muscle as possible. So that matters too. And then I guess that'll end up going back to the, you know, is it grams per mass or ideal mass, you know, and how do you figure that out?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't touch on that. That's a good question. I get asked that a lot. And I say, you know what, we use actual body weight for the main reason that nobody knows what I would love for them to know, but that's their lean mass, right? And we should really be basing these things on lean mass, which is where protein is going to go, as opposed to total body weight. So if you get somebody who's overweight or obese, I say, you know, once you hit a BMI of about 30, then I begin to talk about just leaving protein requirements as if they had a BMI of 30. So even if they have a BMI of 35 or 40, there's no need to feed protein to that level of body weight. You can kind of, you know, just clamp them at 30. And I guess that's sort of ideal-ish in the way it's set up. You know, ideal body weight to me, I mean, you know,
there's no ideal.
Nobody in North America has the ideal body weight anymore. A few people.
That's what I wondered, if we should be doing this based upon height almost sometimes, but
Yeah, you know what? I've seen that. And, in a lot of circumstances, it's actually not a bad estimate. I think Eric Helms came up with that one, and, you know, it's uncannily good actually. If you use height in meters, and, you know, I'm 1.83 meters. And he goes, oh, that's grams per kilo. And I'm like, it's not bad. You know, so maybe a little high for me, but not bad.
So we're trying to develop this GLP-1 program. So everybody in these GLP-1s are losing lots of weight.
Yeah.
The thing is, our patients that are coming in, you know, it could be 250, 300, however many, you know, whatever for you, it's going to be 150 kilos or whatever.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
So, and the thing is, it's like, we don't want to, practicality wise, and I don't think they need 1.6 and above grams per kilo. I do think that going down to the 0.8 and below is not adequate, even if they have a lot of adipose to lose. So we try to get them up to like 1.2 if they can, but even practicality, these people, they don't have an appetite from these medicines are so powerful.
Sure.
So it's like you said, there's no ideal weight. We could use lean, and correct me if I'm wrong, and those with obesity, I don't think it's actually, they haven't done these studies where they actually calculate it based off of lean mass. They've done some in total body weight. Mm-hmm. I did just see you have a review on very low calorie diets and protein intake. Could you touch on that then? Because that relates to what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, so we've carried out about four, I just call them traditional weight loss trials. You know, we were in a kinesiology department, so exercise is always involved. But, you know, there's no substitute. The adage is muscle and fitness is made in the gym, but weight is lost in the kitchen. So you got to cut energy back and calories back. And when you do that, you know, people lose weight and then, you know, they get fitter and everything. But you know, the dirty secret is in weight loss is if it's just done without exercise, probably about a quarter of the weight that most people lose is lean tissue, some of which is going to be muscle. Mm-hmm. So in your patients, they're, you know, an example, astonishingly effective drugs, right? And I mean, it's a excellent time to be alive to have something so potent and so powerful. But it's the same with bariatric patients. They lose weight very quickly. It's very effective, but some of what they lose is going to be muscle. And so, you know, you'd like to sort of say, well, as good a health as we're putting you in is that we want you to hold on to that metabolically active tissue that, you know, once you're a little bit older is also going to help you get around. Two things. I mean, first, I know I'm preaching the converted, but, you know, lift weights.
Yeah,
that's by far the most powerful.
I think we need to get into that a little bit more.
Yeah,
I do want to get it because that's always debated. Like our thing is like, if you're not lifting, then this whole point is moot.
Well, and I think, I mean, and you're about to tell us, but the data, we're very confident, show that the resistance training is more of a, or needs to be more of a priority than splitting the hairs that we're talking about today.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, no, it's hands down, it's the far superior stimulus to hanging on to muscle than just increasing protein intake. I mean,
okay.
it's sort of, nutrition alone, I call it a very passive way of trying to sort of correct the issue. The extreme example is to go into the ICU. You've got somebody who's, in a bed, very sick, all kinds of issues, and you're just trying to flood them with protein to counteract the loss of muscle. And it's not very effective at all until you can either you get electrical stimulation or something to make the patient mobile. And that, even though it's not a big stimulus, it's a contractile stimulus that sort of opens up the muscle and makes it receptive to nutrients like protein. So, anything above the RDA for your patients would be good.
Yeah,
because of their lower appetite, and if they're, that would be a time, and it's not often I say is that supplements probably could be, a true, a savior in that time, because of the quality of the protein that you get in these supplements. So they're isolated, there's no fiber or anti-nutritional component to them. They tend to be very high quality, especially if they're dairy-based, so whey or casein. And that would be, the protein that I might push to sort of preserve lean tissue.
So like with the VLs, very low calorie diet, like what was the gist of it? I mean, you're basically saying, because I know a lot of these things looked at, they look at percentage, like 30% of your calories should come from protein. That's a lot of these obesity trials,
but that's
probably not the best way to do it. If your calories are getting so low, your protein's going low, as opposed to just setting it at a certain per. So what was your conclusion of this?
Yeah, exactly what I just said. I mean, by far the biggest driver of retention of lean, so if these are way back in time, sort of late 60s, early 70s, to what they called protein modified fasts, right? Mm-hmm. So you get these metabolically very unhealthy patients, but you get them in hospital and you pull them back, or you put them on a calorie diet that's about 800 calories a day. And in those scenarios, when you up the protein, it helps preserve a little bit of lean. But our point is, we've been able to do the, what in our world we call body recomp, where we take even fairly, not particularly overweight individuals, and we are able to get them to lose fat and gain muscle at the same time. But we do that not because they get more protein, but because they lift weights. It's like the potency of it compared to just diet is, I don't know what fold, but it's definitely a fold of difference. So your advice to your patients is sound for sure.
Here's a question for you. We are trying to develop, and we may eventually get this done. We really want to see a trial with these new incretin therapies, either tirzepatide or semaglutide, whatever.
Yeah.
And it would be really interesting to know. They haven't done this yet. Mm-hmm. It would be interesting to know, let's get as much protein as we can up to 1.6. I don't think we're going to get them up that high, but let's say. Yeah. And let's get them resistance training, let's say, not just recommendations and seeing what people like, literally supervise as close as possible.
Yep.
They've done similar with these VLCD type of
trials. There is one trial that's out there, and it was with liraglutide, where it was a 2x2 factorial trial. The results are in the New England Journal.
They had an
exercising group.
Yeah. It was part resistance, part aerobic. And it, mm-hmm. as far as I know, it looked, I don't know if they did DEXAs. I can't remember. You could pull it up if you want. But have they done it with just no drug, and they've done VLCDs with this type of thing?
That's, no.
So because I think, and we should get Brad Schoenfeld on here because we were talking with him.
Yeah.
Like if we do it properly, we think the muscle loss will be minimal if we do it correctly. Yeah. But people are skeptical. They're like, no, you can't stop the muscle loss. I'd
be willing to bet you that you could. I mean, we wrote a commentary, myself and a couple of students in the lab, on that 2x2 liraglutide trial.
Yeah, that's right.
For the main reason that in the original paper, they just sort of, they they gloss over it a lot. And I think it was much more aerobic than it was resistance. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, so let's just say they probably underdosed the resistance that they gave these folks. But the main reason that we highlighted the paper in the British Journal of Sports Medicine was that was the only group that reported an increase in health-related quality of life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm fond of saying is that, you know, exercise is awesome. And it's almost embarrassing. It's so good. But it's also really good when you add it to other things that work, and it makes everything better.
Yeah, I mean, just a quick little recap of that trial, Spencer. The liraglutide plus exercise, of course, lost more weight than, you know, certainly placebo gained weight. Exercise maintained weight. Liraglutide itself lost a little bit of weight. Exercise, liraglutide lost the most weight and had, of course, the best improvement in body fat percentage. So liraglutide and exercise actually had a similar almost 2% body fat percentage improvement, whereas exercise plus liraglutide had better than more of a 3.5% body fat percentage loss. You know, and like you said, there was, you know, all the other benefits.
It's kind of interesting because, you know, when they look at these DEXA scans, we had Grant Tinsley on here. Do you know Dr.
Grant? Oh, yeah.
So because everybody uses these DEXA scans and it's like, well, that doesn't necessarily tell you the muscle specifically. No. It's a surrogate of it. So I have patients that, you know, it ranges. I had one patient that had only 10% like lean mass loss and they've lost almost 100 pounds. And it's like, okay, I don't think these things are specifically catabolic. I know that's what, you know, Peter Attia and some of these other people are saying,
count this as another notch in the belt of giving a little knock to Peter Attia.
Yeah, the Peter Attia. We call this the Peter Attia.
We usually
Attia
knock
hater.
Him down every podcast.
We call it the Peter Attia hater podcast.
I'll let the shoe drop and tell you that, you know, my most precious commodity is time. It's a short list of pods that I listen to, and hand on heart, you guys are in there. I got Attia because he's a smart guy and I like
him. He is smart.
I don't listen. I can't listen to Huberman because it's 3 hours long.
Yeah.
It's too much, right? And so there are one or two other. I don't want to call them out, but I mean, so I like Peter's podcast for a lot of reasons. There's a couple of times I'm just like,
And that's what we get into. I mean, he's a smart dude and he says some really good things. Once in a while, he starts extending himself into areas where he says things and he's kind of wrong. And we're like, oh, come on, man. But anyways,
there's no reason, I think, for him to say these things. And it makes me just go like, going there? I'm actually certain inside, I don't think you really believe that, but it's a little bit of hype. So,
a little bit of marketing.
You know, if I ever got the chance to meet him in person, I'd shake the guy's hand and say,
"Oh yeah,
you're doing an awesome job." But every now and again, I'm like, "Dude, just I'm wearing the McMaster brand. We think we're the home of evidence-based, or we like to say we are anyway. So I'm going to say evidence-based just a few times on the podcast, or I get kicked out of the club, right? So. I'm like, that's not evidence-based, you know? So.
Right, I know.
Yeah.
Well, we like to have people like you on here because we don't know everything. Yeah. We don't know what we're talking about.
We don't have a monopoly on it here. I mean, think we do, but we don't.
So,
if the club meeting's on Tuesday, we admit it to ourselves. We do not know everything, you know? So,
sorry about the tangent.
Yeah, the tangent. Okay,
yes, sorry.
So patients will lose 10%. Like, But then I had another patient, they did lose around 30% lean.
Yeah.
Matt, it may have been a little bit more, and it's like more than what you'd expect. It was on a DEXA, but they're like, I don't understand. My deadlifts went up 100 pounds. I can do pull-ups now. So
yeah, they're stronger.
My question for you, and this might not be your forte, but quality of muscle, strength, function, more so than just what it shows on a DEXA scan. I don't know. You might know this stuff better than I do.
So you had Grant on, and there's nobody better than Grant to explain, you know, what a DEXA does and what a DEXA doesn't, right? So he's spot on. DEXA is... It essentially, through subtraction, so it measures bone, which is what it's made to do, and that's what it's best at doing. It measures fat, and then it gives you total body. It actually measures area, not mass, but it does some extrapolations. And you get fat and bone-free mass. Now, that we call that lean, some of which is going to be muscle, but it also includes all your organs and water and everything else. So it's hard to use it as sort of a, you know, how good or bad, because in some people it can be spot on. In other people, it's not as good. And all bets are off when you lose weight and you change body water pools and everything else like that as to which is the best. So let me just say this, is that it's sort of, you know, what direction is the wind blowing, even though people think it's the gold standard. And I think that that's probably a good estimate or reasonable. But strength is something you can completely divorce from muscle if you're lifting. Because as you guys know, you know, you want to get better at doing the combine, you practice for the combine. So if you're practicing lifting heavy stuff, you get better at lifting heavy stuff. And so it's probably the best of all worlds. No matter how much lean you lose, if you get smaller and yet functionally stronger, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned earlier, quality of life measures too, physical ability. I mean, that's
absolutely
who cares what the DEXA says if you are healthier and living your life better. And Spencer, by the way, just going back to that liraglutide plus exercise trial, in that, not only did the liraglutide and exercise group have significant amount of fat mass loss, they actually had a slight increase in lean mass, according to that trial.
By DEXA.
Yeah, right.
A fine point on what we were just talking about. I don't know that that's, you know, muscle building per se, but it's definitely much closer to negating muscle loss, right? And you know, you guys know this, and I think everybody realizes it. Muscle, as you get older, it goes down, and it's one of the main reasons that age is a negative factor in all of the predictive energy expenditure equations, because the older you are, the less muscle you have. And, you know, nobody's having a crisis of their liver, which is a small but yet very metabolically active tissue. So preservation of muscle is a good thing. And you want to keep that as long as you can into later life when it becomes an issue around mobility.
I'm trying my best.
Yeah,
I'm ahead of you, but I'm also doing my best. Yes.
All right. So I think we captured most of it. One point. So yeah, I see all other people. You know, our buddy Alan Aragon and all these. They always are arguing with you back and forth on Twitter about, like, why not get more? Get the 2.2, Jose Antonio, all these other people.
Yeah.
You know, like the thing is, like, that's a. I think it's a very niche population that might consider going higher, like if they just want to make sure that they eke out every tiny little ounce of.
And that's, and they're also talking about trained athletes.
These are like
lifting a lot, also you know, cutting calories, energy deficit, keeping as much, you know, I mean, that's splitting a lot of hairs, whereas most people, even probably most athletes, I would think, would benefit more from this more pragmatic approach. And it's very important for us to be able to help with patients. Now, is one thing I don't know, but it matters because we have kids. And we have a couple little meathead boys and a couple of little athletic girls.
Yes.
I don't know. Do you know much about their protein requirements at all? Or is that, do we need to go get a pediatric?
You'd need somebody better than me. I'll just give you my N of three experience. Okay. So I have three sons. They're all older than your kids. And I only know because you guys post pictures of your kids. And so my youngest is 18. The oldest is 24. They were all, well, one still is, I guess, competitively. Like, they're all very good ice hockey players. Number two, I mentioned to you, he's a wrestler, and that kid's, he's leaner at this point in his life than I ever was as a rugby guy. The bottom line to me is that I've never said anything to them about supplements. They do use protein supplements, but it's certainly, I've drilled it into them. I'm like, food first, supplements convenient. So that's how they use them. But you know, it's not naive enough to think that like a lot of particularly young boys, they're looking for something. But as you guys, you know, would probably know, I think for kids, there's a whole list of things that you could tweak before you would say, you know, supplements maybe are so. Are you going to the gym? How hard do you work when you get there? How often do you go? How much are you sleeping? How much, you know, blah, 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 blah. Lots of other things that you could probably say. You should improve on this before we talk about supplements. So I'm not a huge fan of trying to get kids to take a supplement. I get asked a lot by coaches, particularly, you know, my blah, blah, blah. Would you think if we got this kid on creatine? And I'm like, you know, I'm like, I think if you got the kid maybe
working
a solid 8 hours of sleep or, let's check a, you know, a grid while he's worked out three times in the last month and, you know,
And as far as like actual protein requirements, probably most of the kids get that. I mean, obviously my son, he probably eats more protein than in a day than I do at this point. He's a little meathead.
On a per kilo body weight basis.
Spencer knows. He quadruple birders from plate. It's like, come on, man.
It's actually, it's hard for me to watch my boys eat food because it's disgusting, actually. Like, I think at some point, like, that was definitely me. And the great, you know, part about being young is that you're growing, right? Yeah. So there's this diversionary sort of sink for excess calories and protein and everything. It's not obviously not infinite because we've also got lots of kids who are overweight and obese. Sure. But certainly if you're an active kid and you're involved in all these things, it's as if you just can't shovel coal into the furnace fast enough.
It is amazing.
Things on all the time, right? So, that goes away just so that all of your young listeners,
That's actually a great point for anyone listening and listening. We don't want you to have to see us someday. And so prevention is key, primordial prevention, good nutrition, exercise. Keep it up. We don't want you to struggle with obesity and diabetes and end up having to see us later.
Yes.
Well, Stu, it's been fun.
Amazing. I'm so happy. I'm going to make a little chart now that I've talked to you based upon height and estimated protein requirements for my patients.
I think you got to tap Eric Helms. I think that was his invention or whatever. It's astonishingly good, though. It's height in meters, 1 point blank meters.
You know, you were talking about like a BMI of kind of 30, you know, as that, you know, sort if I go like what people's weight is at each height for a BMI of 30, that would be kind of a reasonable target for my patients, right?
I think it's a good peg. Yeah. I get asked the question you guys asked a lot by dietitians in particular, and I struggle, and I've done some back of the envelope calculations, and I think that's probably pretty good, but Eric's the guy who deserves the credit for the height one.
It makes me feel better that, you know, even you have sort of mentally struggled with that as we have, because it's not perfect science. I mean,
no, it's not.
Thank you for making me feel better.
We don't have the data for me to give you the exact number, but I will say this, and you mentioned that people say, oh, there's no way you can prevent the lean. I would strongly dispute that with these drugs. And I think there may be, like, they're doing something to muscle that we don't quite understand. I don't know if it's catabolic per se. Definitely the reduction in overall energy intake is driving the catabolic side of things. Mm-hmm. But I would, with enough, like a sufficient dose and intensity and frequency of resistance training, I would bet that that's what we think.
Yeah, we need the data. We need the data.
Absolutely.
All right, strength training, Doc Sulik podcast.
Follow Stu on Twitter. Don't harass him too much.
Harassment's fine. Harass away.
Really appreciate it. This was amazing. I really, really thank you so much.
Same. It's a pleasure to hang with you guys for sure.
Thank you for everything. Here's our outro, everyone. Share this with somebody you think will benefit from eating some more protons.
Basically everybody.